Case number 08-5092, Charles Blaine Jones, appellant versus Ben S. Bernanke, Chairman, Board of Governors, Federal Reserve Board. Mr. Kane for the appellant, Mr. Curé for the appellee.
Kane, I'm sure you're very disappointed that the crowd was not gathered to hear your oratory. Once they clear, you may begin.
May it please the court, my name is Michael Kane, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Charles Blaine Jones. We are here today on Mr. Jones's appeal of several rulings from the district court that dismissed Mr. Jones's claims that he was discriminated against on the basis of age and gender when, first, the defendant, Federal Reserve, selected a substantially younger female for the position of manager of the specialized activity section. And second, that defendant retaliated against Mr. Jones for objecting to this discrimination and participating in the EEO process when it lowered his performance for the years 2000 through 2003. With regard to the non-selection claim, it is our position that the court erred when it denied Mr. Jones's request for discovery. We submitted in our opposition a 56F affidavit which set out several items that we believe were necessary to successfully oppose that summary judgment motion. And just by way of background, after we filed this case in federal court, the Federal Reserve responded with a motion to dismiss or for summary judgment, and we actually had no discovery at all. And in the administrative proceeding, the administrative judge had dismissed the non-promotion claim at issue here. So we had no paper discovery on that issue, although there was some limited discovery in depositions. But those questions were taken, or those questions were asked without the benefit of any paper discovery. We filed that 56F affidavit in our opposition, and the judge denied that. We believe it was an abuse of discretion to do so. We think, I just want to point out two items in particular here and highlight those. The court, in ruling that we did not make a prima facie case on the gender claim, concluded that our argument that Mr. Schemerin's testimony that there was this policy of promoting young women as fast as possible was nothing more than a diversity policy, which was legitimate. And that was something we had specifically sought in our 56F affidavit, was information concerning this diversity policy. And the court, in its decision, really credited the defendant with the benefit of the doubt on that policy, that Mr. Schemerin was representing in his deposition an actual legitimate affirmative action policy. So that did hurt the plaintiff because the plaintiff was not able to.
There had been deposition on that subject, right?
There was a question asked of Mr. Schemerin in the administrative proceeding, and that's where that testimony came from, where he said there was a policy of promoting young women as soon as possible. But we didn't have any paper discovery.
Could there have been a follow-up to that question at the deposition?
Well, there could have been a follow-up to the question, but we maintain are entitled at in this federal proceeding to have discovery on that issue and not just take Mr. Schemerin's word for it, because what he described does not sound like a legitimate affirmative action policy you know, couched in this characterization of promoting young women as soon as possible. So we did not have the benefit of the paper discovery when we were asking that question. And it did hurt the plaintiff because we the district court found that we did not make out a prima facie case on the gender claim. The other piece of evidence was the performance evaluations of Ms. Richards. The district court also, one of the things we argued was we made out a prima facie case under the court's Mastro precedent on the gender discrimination because there was a significant difference in qualifications. And the court rejected that and relied in part on this representation that Ms. Richards had very good performance evaluations. But again, our 56F affidavit had sought that information, and we did not get that. So we didn't have the benefit of cross-examining any of these defense witnesses on that or using the performance evaluations to undercut the defendant's argument that those evaluations were good evaluations.
Do you want to say something about the court's, the way the district court handled the 2000 evaluation?
The 2000 evaluation?
Yeah.
Well, I think the court really focused too narrowly on the evidence of retaliatory motive. The court singled out this one letter regarding a request for a hearing that was in the September timeframe and sort of initially said that that was sufficiently close in time, but then later reversed itself and said we had no evidence that Ms. Richards knew about that letter.
You also have a Breeden problem on that letter.
Well, I don't think we have a Breeden problem because I don't think we should be focusing just on that letter. I think
the Breeden decision doesn't focus just on the letter. It focuses on the relationship between a later event providing notice or reminding everybody of an ongoing claim and their knowledge of prior the circumstances initiating the claim. And it's not clear to me how you get around that problem.
Well, I think we have evidence that creates an inference of retaliation.
Well, let's just stick with the 922 letter for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's assume arguendo that Richards, others get notice of it, right? Okay, but under Breeden, what does it add to what they already know, what they knew from, I guess, whatever the date of the initial complaint is?
Well, it's different from Breeden in the sense that this is a letter requesting a hearing, which is the next step in the administration.
Well, it was a right to sue letter in Breeden, which is a step towards litigation.
Oh, I think that's there's a big difference between those two. A letter from plaintiff's attorney saying we want a hearing is very different from the EEOC issuing a plaintiff a right to sue letter.
I would say Breeden doesn't focus on the proposition that the right to sue letter came from something other than the complainant. Focuses on the proposition that doesn't really add anything. Though it does, I mean, it's perfectly clear as a matter of literal truth that it does add something. It says, look, this process is moving into a second step.
I don't think the EEOC letter says that. A right to sue letter just tells the plaintiff he has a right to go into court.
Isn't the difference between this case and Breeden that the right to sue letter in Breeden was not a protected act, whereas the letter here requesting a hearing is?
Yes, Your Honor, I agree. I mean, it's part of the letter requesting the hearing here is a participation in the EEO process, and the court did view it as...
I mean, I thought your answer to Judge Williams would have been that here you have an alleged retaliatory act within a month of a protected act under the statute, namely the writing of the letter seeking a hearing.
Yes, Your Honor. That was a protected act, and I do think it is different from Breeden, which is just a right to sue letter, which shows no action on the part of the plaintiff. It's sort of a passive thing where he receives the letter. But here we have the plaintiff actually seeking a hearing, which is the next step in the administrative process, and Ms. Richards and her management is on notice that he is going forward with this and is seeking.
Doesn't your analysis have the effect of making for every retaliation claim, virtually every retaliation claim, have the effect of making the time span, which people have treated as critical in drawing an inference of retaliatory purpose, it's always going to shrink it down to comparatively little, right? There's always some step going on, right? Some
well,
step, and the complainant is almost always going to have some role. didn't have a role in the right to sue letter, to be sure, although that's not the basis that the court relied on. You know, these things drag on, and the complainant does something, and the employer does something, and on it goes. So you've sort of you've asserted a doctrine which eliminates the time span as any kind of a break on inferences of causation.
Well, I don't think that's the facts here. The protected activity here is this, one of the many acts of protected activity here is the 922 letter, and the adverse action was very soon after that. It was just a month later.
I understand that, if the 922 letter qualifies.
Well, even if our argument is that even if the 922 letter does not qualify, we have Mr. Jones's participation, and we have evidence that shows a retaliatory motive on the part of Ms. Richards. She had just given a statement in July, just 2 months earlier, where she had to give a statement defending her actions in Mr. Jones's EEO case.
To be underscoring the point I'm making, that once a complaint is launched, there's step after step as the process grinds along, and your views treat every person's, both the accused supervisor and the complainant and the agencies, all of these are treated as steps which somehow or other provoke the alleged retaliatory act when it happens.
Well, I do think the plaintiff deserves protection while he's going through this process, and our facts in this case show a very tight time frame of June, the summer, and then into the fall, where he's actively participating, as are his management, and then he gets this really unsupported PMP.
Accepting your characterization of temporal proximity, is there anything else to support retaliatory motive on that rating?
Well, I think the actual facts of the rating that we lay out in the brief, that there was really no support for the criticisms in the rating, one can infer from that, absent a rebuttal from the Federal Reserve, which hasn't happened, they chose to rest just on the prima facie case. You can look at the lack of support there. And that's another 56F issue. We wanted the ability to depose the Chicago personnel who had indicated Mr. Jones's performance was at the extraordinary level. And we requested that but did not have the opportunity to get into that issue.
Are you really saying that on the causation point, that always ends up being subject to the sort of substantive analysis of the justification for the act claimed to be retaliatory?
Well, I think that the court has to look at all the evidence here. And in the prima facie of the case, it's a very low threshold, but it's malleable. It's something that you have to devise based on the facts you're presented with. And in this situation, the fact that the evaluation itself was unsupportable, and we laid that out in very good detail in our brief, that's something the court should consider in creating this retaliatory inference that we think merited denial of summary judgment. I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Seeing no questions, thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the appellee.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm John Curry. I'm an attorney with the Federal Reserve Board. I'd like to pick up on the 2000 performance evaluation and this theory of ongoing retaliation. One of the problems with the theory that once the process starts, that there's this continuation is that, as the court's aware, in the day-to-day workplace, there is constant interaction between employees and their supervisors. And if you take this position that once there is knowledge or of some activity, the fact that this activity continues on for a long time, you are basically saying at that point that virtually any act a supervisor takes is going to be viewed potentially as retaliatory.
And isn't the statute supposed to protect people not just from retaliation for filing the original complaint, but from retaliation for participating in the system, in the EEO system?
Certainly,
Judge. I mean, suppose, for example, that they filed a complaint in year one, okay, and 2 years later, and the employer doesn't do anything, but 2 years later, the employee testifies or gives a deposition, and the employer is disturbed, offended by that deposition, and retaliates. Are you saying that the retaliation provision doesn't protect that employee because it's 2 years from the filing of the original complaint?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that, Judge Tatel. And certainly there can be, and this court has recognized in Singletary, this theory of ongoing retaliation.
Right.
It seems then.
No, it's not ongoing retaliation. It's ongoing protection.
Right. But it seems that the key then to this becomes knowledge. That becomes the key element.
Right.
Because if the supervisor doesn't have knowledge.
Okay, now you're changing subjects.
I don't believe
if you want to. That's all right. But that's a different issue.
Well, I think it's actually the same issue, if I may, Your Honor.
Uh-huh.
Because I agree with you that engaging in ongoing protected activity is, in fact, protected.
Okay.
But the key seems to be here that the supervisor has to know of that participation.
Okay. Yeah,
but is that true?
I'm sorry.
No, you go ahead.
As I understand it, the argument is that the supervisor knew about the beginning of this action, and therefore, if something's done later, I'm talking about your opponent's argument, if something is done later, the supervisor is charged with a retaliatory motive just as if he had known of the later act. Is that the way you understand it?
It seems to be the theory that
As I understood the record, there was no showing of knowledge on the part of the supervisor of the appeal letter.
Absolutely. In this record, there is no showing whatsoever. And in fact, what appellant has claimed is knowledge can be presumed, knowledge can be assumed, but there is nothing in the record that supervisors who provided the 2000 performance evaluation knew of that activity.
But their argument is that, and I want to separate, when I ask this question, I want to separate the prima facie case from the ultimate question of retaliation, okay? Their argument is that at the prima facie case stage, which is everybody agrees is not to be onerous, right? All you need at that point is evidence that the employer knew. And as I look at our cases, that seems to be right. Now, I agree, ultimately, for them to prevail, they need to show that the supervisor who took the retaliatory act knew. But what do you cite for the support of the proposition that you need that very specific information at the prima facie stage?
Your Honor, I don't really think it matters at which stage you're talking about. Without that knowledge of the supervisor, how can they act with the necessary retaliatory?
No, remember, at the prima facie stage, the purpose of the prima facie stage of the McDonnell-Douglas test is to determine whether there's sufficient evidence to shift to the employer the obligation to come forward with a proffered non, in this case, retaliatory explanation, right?
Correct.
Okay. And it's not, and the prima facie case is supposed to be easy to me, right? It's not onerous. And the cases I've seen all talk about the employer or officials. I haven't found a case where we've said that at the prima facie case, the specific employee who took the action had to know. Now, once they've made out their prima facie case by showing that the employer knew, it shifts the burden to the employer, and the employer may ultimately be able to prove that the supervisor in this case knew nothing, in which case they'd win.
But why?
But we're only talking about the prima facie stage here.
But why put, Your Honor, the employer through the burden of producing that explanation?
Because the argument is that according to the cases I've read, that if the employer knew about the protected act, that's enough at the prima facie stage. We can just assume that if the employer knew, then the others knew. You don't have to make that assumption, and that assumption won't get you anywhere on the merits because you have to prove it. But I think that's what they're arguing, and you didn't cite a case. I can't find a case that says that the individual, at the prima facie case stage, the individual supervisors had to know.
I don't.
You have one?
I do not, no. Your Honor. I do not believe this circuit's law makes that distinction. But may I present, I guess, an analogy, which is, if this morning before I came to court, I went and filed an EEO complaint with the board's EEO programs director, and my supervisor, Ms. Wheatley, who's sitting in the courtroom, is the subject of that complaint. When I sit down in a few moments and she looks at me and says, that is the worst performance I've ever seen in an oral argument, and you're going to suffer for this. The distinction becomes critical is her knowledge, because if she knew about the complaint, the temporal proximity is so close as to create retaliatory intent. But if she had no knowledge, even though the agency now knows of my complaint, she can't be seen as retaliating.
If she had no knowledge, that's a fact question about it. Your employer knew about it. But now, you might ultimately easily win on the grounds that she didn't, but that's not this case, right? Here you also have evidence. I mean, the inference is not as difficult in this case as it is in your hypothetical, because here the supervisors, not only was the letter sent to the same office, the same Washington agency where they work, but they were participating in the EEO process.
They certainly had been involved in the process through that time, yes.
Okay.
But the argument here, I guess, Your Honor, is that absent that knowledge of that specific step, what you're back to is presuming that they have this generalized knowledge, and that's sufficient for them to have or develop this retaliatory intent. Because the inference, the temporal proximity argument is, in the absence of any other showing of retaliatory intent, we create this inference simply by virtue of the close connection between the two events, the letter being sent and the performance evaluation. But without knowledge of that specific intent or that specific event, it's difficult to see how the supervisor...
Let me go back to my original case. Do you have a case that says that at the prima facie stage, you need to show that the particular supervisor who took the alleged retaliatory act actually knew, as opposed to the employer knowing?
The language this court has used consistently in its decisions is employer.
Right.
But... Right. It seems, Judge, that even at the prima facie case stage, you still need to show that it's the decision maker.
In Holcomb, for example,
you simply do not create the inference of retaliatory intent without knowledge of the actual decision maker. Without that knowledge, it's difficult to see or conceive how my supervisor.
So under your theory, would you then permit discovery at the prima facie stage for the employer to show what the supervisor knew? Of course you wouldn't.
Well,
your argument would be you're not entitled to discovery at that point, right?
Well, in this particular case, we would point out two things. The first is that there was discovery in the administrative process in regard to these performance evaluations. The supervisors who provided them, in fact, were deposed and answered all the questions in regard to those. And the second thing we would point out is in the Rule 57...
Didn't all that discovery occur prior to the 2000 letter?
No, not at all, Your Honor. It occurred afterwards. The depositions of Ms. Richards and Mr. Martinson, as I recall, were in late 2002, early 2003. Uh-huh. It was well into the process.
It's affidavits or something in 2000.
There are affidavits in June, Your Honor. I believe it was in June and July of 2000. Mr. Martinson and Ms. Richards gave affidavits to the EEO investigator. When the appellant requests the hearing in September of 2000, that begins when the EEOC finally acknowledges it a year later, that begins the pre-hearing phase before the EEOC. The depositions of Ms. Richards, Mr. Martinson, Mr. Shimmering all occur late 2002, early 2003. So we're well into the PMPs that he's claiming to be retaliatory.
Let me ask you a different kind of question. And tell me why, I assume you think this is wrong. Tell me why you think it's wrong. It seems to me the problem here wasn't so much the way the district court handled the prima facie case, although I'm still not convinced by your argument that there wasn't enough here, but that in a case like this one where the employer has come forward with a non-retaliatory explanation, that at that point the prima facie case drops out, and what the district court should have done was looked at the underlying question of whether there was sufficient evidence of retaliation in the case, looking at all the evidence, the prima facie case, the response to the non-discriminatory reason, and everything else. Right? Isn't that right? Isn't that what our case law says?
I'm not sure, Judge, that I would agree that the prima facie case drops out.
No, the evidence of the prima facie case is relevant to the ultimate question of discrimination, vel not.
And I think,
but the question the district court should focus on, once the employer has come forward with a non-discriminatory reason, is discrimination, or in this case, retaliation, not the question of a prima facie case.
And that certainly has been this.
Isn't that right?
Yes, that is.
That's correct, right?
Decisions.
Okay, so you agree with that. Okay, so looking at it that way, why couldn't a jury conclude from the evidence in this case that the supervisors did know? And there's two categories of evidence. One is the fact that we've already discussed, that they participated in the process. But second, the plaintiff has offered evidence that the 2000 evaluation was pretext. And we've held, now I don't know whether it is or not, but he said, for example, that at least two of the projects he was criticized for producing late, he was never really assigned. And he has that in his affidavit. So why couldn't a jury conclude, a reasonable jury conclude, from that evidence and from the evidence that the supervisor participated in the EEO process and that the letter was sent to the agency, that the supervisor was proceeding on a retaliatory motive?
Because I think it goes back to the same point, Your Honor. We go back to the knowledge issue. We go back.
That's just what I'm asking you. We've held, right, from a plaintiff's evidence that the employer's action was pretext, the jury can conclude discrimination, right?
Correct.
Okay. And if the jury believes the plaintiff's testimony here and disbelieves the employer, why can't it conclude from that the only explanation was retaliation for a protected act?
If you reach that point in the process, it could.
Right.
The point we've been raising, Your Honor, is it shouldn't reach that point in the process.
But I thought you just agreed with me that that once the employer comes forward with a proffered non-retaliatory reason, the question before the court is retaliation vel non, not whether there was a prima facie case. That's what our cases say.
Even retaliation vel non requires knowledge.
Okay, well, we're going in circles. Okay.
I'm sorry.
It could be the rule, perhaps it is the rule, that depending upon the relationship between the alleged retaliatory act and the employer's justification of the act, a jury could infer knowledge, which is otherwise unshown completely.
I don't know
whether that is the law, but one can imagine such a rule.
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because it's the way this court has formulated the requirement is that there is knowledge on behalf of.
I had supposed that to be the case, but.
And Judge Tatel, could I? I know I'm out of time.
No, go ahead.
But I'd just like to point one other thing out. You talked about discovery. If you look at the Rule 56F affidavit for the retaliation claims, mm-hmm. there was never a request for information regarding knowledge of the supervisors as to any of the EEO activity. So that Rule 56F, Rule 56F affidavit.
Okay, I understand that, but you agreed with me that once the employer comes forward with a non-retaliatory explanation, the question before the court is, was there or was there not retaliation? So the only question then is whether a jury could legitimately conclude from evidence that the employer's explanation was pretext that there was, in fact, retaliation. That's the question.
Correct.
Right?
That question still requires the knowledge element.
Right, but why couldn't the jury, let's assume that the jury is completely convinced here that this 2000 evaluation is complete pretext, that the work that he was criticized for not doing on time was never assigned to them, okay? Let's assume it's really crystal clear, okay?
Okay.
And that evaluation came, 5 weeks after the letter seeking a hearing, right?
Correct.
Are you saying to me that the jury could not conclude on the basis of that the supervisor was acting on the basis of, was responding to the fact that the person requested a hearing?
I'm not saying the jury couldn't conclude that. Right. I guess my argument is the jury should never get that question to begin with.
Why?
Because he has not shown, be it in his prima facie case or be it
in... You're back to your prima facie case.
No.
Yeah, you are.
Your Honor...
Finish your sentence, please.
I'm sorry.
The sentence you just started there, finish it.
Yeah. Thank
you. He has not shown either in his prima facie case
or retaliation vel non that the supervisors knew about his protected activity. It doesn't matter, it seems, whether it's the formulation is prima facie case or retaliation vel non. There still has to be knowledge of that activity. In the absence of that knowledge, the case should not go to the jury. The jury should not have the ability to decide if, in fact, crystal clear that the performance evaluation was pretext.
Okay, now, are there further questions?
No, I have no further questions.
Seeing none, your time is...
Thank you, Your Honor.
We're showing our propensity for taking counsel beyond their assigned time this morning, which is all right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. How much time left for rebuttal?
2 minutes.
2 minutes for rebuttal.
Well, I'd like to start with a question. Did you make the argument that knowledge in this case can be inferred, knowledge on the part of Richards can be inferred from the disparity between the truth of the matter and the character of the 2000 PMP?
I think we did. I think we did in our reply brief talk about...
I saw a lot of arguments and citations to the Second Circuit and Seventh Circuit about general corporate knowledge, but I didn't see this argument.
Well, I know we talked about discrimination vel non and how the court has to look at the whole case once legitimate reasons are offered. And I think that in the typical case, the management is usually going to deny knowledge. And because we're at summary judgment, that is really a fact issue. Under the Reeves case, the jury is not required to believe that representation. So if this case had gone to a jury, we certainly would have had management's denial of knowledge of the letter, but we would have been able to put on evidence that the actual retaliation, that the actual evaluations did not have merit, that they were just totally at odds with reality. And based on that, a jury could have not believed management's representation that they were unaware of the protected activity, because a rational employer is usually not going to criticize an employee for, you know, assignments that they haven't been given. So I do think that this was an issue that had fact issues and should have gone to a jury.
Seeing no further questions then, thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.
Thank you.
Now, there will be a brief recess before we take up the next matter, and the courtroom is being sealed at the request of the parties.